Welcome to Conversations on Buddha Nature. This is a project of Sauder Foundation associated with the Buddha Nature Resource website. So I encourage you all to go and take a look at that if you haven't seen it yet. This is a series of online interviews we will host with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature. For this second event, Lopan Dr. Karmapunso will discuss Buddha Nature as the foundation of freedom with world-renowned Buddhist scholar, teacher, author, and translator, Dr. Robert Thurman, affectionately known as Bob. Bob held the first endowed chair in Buddhist studies in the West, the Jetsong Kapa Chair in Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies, before retiring at the end of 2019. Educated at Harvard, he then studied Tibet, Tibetan Buddhism, and Asian languages and histories for 50 years with many teachers, and was one of the first Westerners ever to be ordained as a monk by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. He has written many substantial scholarly and popular works and supported many scholars in completing PhDs and publishing translations and monographs. He founded the American Institute of Buddhist Studies at Columbia University and is the editor-in-chief of the Treasury of the Buddhist Sciences series, now published with Wisdom Publications. One of the major commentaries on Buddha Nature teachings that represents Jetsong Kapa's views on the subject was published in this series and makes Gyaltsep Dharma Rinchen's detailed commentary on the Gyulama, or Uttara Tantra Shastra, or Ratnagotra Vibhaga, available for the first time in English. Bob also regularly leads Tibet House-sponsored retreats at the Menla Center in upstate New York, and lectures all over the world in the public intellectual tradition, with special concern for ethics and human rights in general. He was awarded the prestigious Padma Shri Award in 2020, for his help in recovering India's ancient Buddhist heritage. And Lopan Dr. Karmapunso is the new recipient of Sauder Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence grant for Buddha Nature Studies and will be our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karmapunso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder and president of Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist study circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Dr. Robert Thurman joining us from New York and Karmapunso joining us from Thimphu in Bhutan.
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you. Kamala. Kuzuzambola. Oh, I can't hear
you. You're muted still, Kamala. You're muted. Yeah, unmute.
Okay.
Oh, there you are.
So, Kuzuzangpo from Thimphu.
Kuzuzangpo.
And before we get into the conversations, let's spend a brief moment bringing our awareness to where we are and cultivate the right intention.
Okay. All right. Oh, to meditate for a minute. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Gisela or Bob, as I often call you, welcome to the conversations on Buddha Nature. It's a great honor for us to have you. Through these conversations, it's our hope to develop a space for exchanging views, insights, and experiences on Buddha Nature and related topics.
Yes.
And I often say this is a forum where we try to practice right speech, mindful listening, and wholesome exploration of meaning in life and existence as a whole. So right. It's a great honor to have you,
you.
Talk
honor to
us and help us promote this ethos of Buddha nature or innate goodness, positive perception. I would like to actually, given your very rich background, now being a leading advocate and teacher of Buddhism, particularly of Tibetan Buddhism, with such great stature and influence, I've heard you speak so many times. I've read many works that you have written. I think with your stature, I'm quite actually interested to know when and where you first encountered this concept of Buddha nature and what kind of impression you had, if you can recall.
Yes, well, I think I thought about that question, and I think the first time I did was maybe reading the Lankavatara Sutra, where the Buddha mentions the Buddha nature. And I think that context was the context of reassuring those who had a strong view of self, of the reality of their self, strong belief in that, reassuring them that there was something like that in the Buddha's teaching, even though the Buddha's, one of his main teachings was the teaching of selflessness. And I believe that's how I understood it, as a kind of stratagem for reassuring people that the selflessness, the lack of self, had to do with a certain type of self, self conceived as an absolute, unchanging, fixed identity within a person. So the idea that a person had a Buddha nature was presented sort of as a strategy, a teaching strategy to reassure someone who feared, who would mistake selflessness for thinking that Buddha was teaching nihilism, that you don't exist at all. And that's how I think I first encountered it, and I appreciated it for that reason. And then second, I encountered it in and thought about it more deeply when I was working for my PhD at Harvard, working on the, but I was doing the work in India at that time in the 1971. And I was almost 50 years ago, and I was seeing there that really it means emptiness. I mean, I got the idea that that's mainly what it means, and emptiness in the sense that a being is susceptible or to transformation into Buddhahood. So emptiness being the guarantee of the relativity of all things, therefore one could develop and evolve to becoming a Buddha, even though one was an ignorant being to start with. And so I left it there. And then only at the more recently, I would say maybe 8-10 years ago, one of my graduate students, a Chinese gentleman actually, by the name of Marty Jiang, who got a PhD with me from China, and he translated the long chapter in the Uttara Tantra on the element, you know, the way in which the Buddha nature is treated there. And through translating into Chinese and English both, the Buddha nature theory in there. And that is when I had my strongest sense of the Buddha nature, actually. And I was so delighted, I've been delighted ever since, which is the idea that what the Buddha nature really is the Buddha's mind in us. Because the Dharmakaya of Buddha is, I think the best translation of Dharma in that context is reality itself. So the reality body of Buddha, if we translate Dharmakaya like that, is everything. A Buddha is a being who feels they are everything. And that means everything, including the beings. And so a Buddha completely empathizes with all the beings and feels he is them somehow, inconceivably, simultaneously with being the Buddha. And therefore, Buddha thinks he's you and me and Marcus. And all the people here. And he's fully aware, therefore, from the inside, so to speak, of all our obscurations and this and that. But because of his oneness with us, from his point of view, which is a better point of view than ours, it's an enlightened point of view, we have this oneness with him and this potential to be equal to him, which he wants us to be. He's unhappy as we are. Actually, he's not unhappy at all, but he realized he feels our unhappiness. He's able to feel our unhappiness by being fully empathetic with the way we feel. So therefore, his presence in us, as us, is our Buddha nature, the way that Yeltsup Jay and the way that Maitreya Nata portrays it in that, and Asanga's own commentary on that. Arya Asanga's commentary on that, Pagma Togmela. So then, ever since then, I feel very happy with the idea of Buddha nature, in the sense of I feel the closeness of the Shakyamuni Buddha and all the Buddhas, of course, because there's no difference between Buddhas in the reality body level, right? Although, of course, that's ultimately, that's just a bunch of language I just said. And that is ultimately inconceivable, naturally, like the Buddha's nature, inexpressible, you know, which I'm very fond of Buddha for that reason. I'm fond of him that that he knows everything, but then he admitted right away he couldn't explain it exactly. He could only give, you know, perspectives. I think we might have lost Karmala, Marcus.
Yeah, he's still there, supposedly, but he seems to have disappeared.
I see. Hmm. Okay.
Let's wait one. Oh, here he comes.
Oh, there
back.
He is. Oh, good.
Well, I'm back. Yes. Thanks.
Oh, good. Was your connection cut, or did you just something else happen?
A little poor today, but I'm back. Please continue.
Okay, good. So did you hear the last part of what I said?
Yes, so I heard about you talking about your Chinese student doing a study of the Ratnagotra Vibhaga and Asanga's commentary, yes, that you came across. In fact, I want to ask you, so you presented an almost a sort of evolution of your understanding of Buddha nature, from first understanding it as a way to avoid a nihilistic understanding of selflessness, and then moving on to Lakavatara understanding, and now a more sort of absolutist understanding presented in the Ratnagotra Vibhaga. Do you think that's also the kind of phase the Western understanding of Buddha nature as a whole has gone through, or is this more impersonal?
Well, I don't know. I don't think that most Western people, I think most Western scholars who study about it, I don't think they think of it as like the Buddha's presence in one, because I don't think they acknowledge, or, you know, in other words, I had read Ratnagotra Vibhaga long before that, but somehow it didn't click in my mind until I read that commentary. I had to edit it in detail because my Chinese student, you know, English was not his mother tongue and so on. And his translation into Chinese was stronger for him. And so I had to do a lot of editing on the English. And as the editor of the series, we published it. And in spending that time, it suddenly came alive. Maybe it's also my age, or I don't know. I don't really know, but I hadn't noticed it. And I don't think people do feel it that way, because I think that, you know, the cataphatic, as we say in English, you know, apophatic and cataphatic. And you know that kind of terminology from Oxford. You know, the cataphatic approach to Buddhism in general is not that, they don't get into it that much, I think, the contemporary people who study it. And they tend to think of Buddhism as sort of skepticism, and they think of Madhyamaka as kind of really almost like nihilistic and so on. It still is the cliche or stereotype, wrong stereotype about Mahayana Buddhism or Buddhism as a whole in the West, is that it's kind of world negating, you know, life rejecting, world negating, all this kind of terminology they have from Max Weber and others. And so they don't see that, and which is too bad, you know. But I think they will slowly, you know. Actually, you know, I'm tired of I'm changing the name of my institute to, before I die, I'm changing the name to Buddhological Studies, because I don't like Buddhist studies. Because I was always uncomfortable with it, because it sounds like Buddhists are doing studies, or else it's the study of Buddhists. It isn't the study of Buddha, because I think the Westerners don't want to admit that the Buddha has a different consciousness than themselves, you know? And I have a joke, actually, that I make recently to Western Buddhist studies people. I say, you guys know very well that Buddha couldn't have been enlightened. And then they look at me and they say, why do you say that? And I say, well, because Buddha didn't have a PhD from Oxford. So he couldn't have been enlightened. You know, you think of him as a pre-modern person, you know, from a underdeveloped culture. So how could he have been enlightened? You know, in other words, the prejudice of the modern people is like that, I'm afraid. You know? So therefore, Buddhology, I like it. That's not used much in America. But I like the word Buddhology because then the logy part means the study of Buddha, not the study of Buddhists, but the study of Buddha. And that's what our primary study should be, I believe. You know? You know, because Buddha is something different, you know? From ourselves.
I couldn't agree more with that because even for a non-native English speaker and student, Buddhist studies sounds like studying Buddhists rather than Buddhism.
That's right.
But then, Bob, when you look at the reception of Buddhism in the West, you know, including use of terminologies, and then especially introducing fairly advanced concepts of non-self, of Buddha nature, what has the reception been like in your experience? You know, because you have lived for much part of that transmission of
Buddhism.
Well,
I think the reception is very good. I think but it's a strange reception. You know, it took me a long time because, of course, I was born in a family which was nominally Protestant Christian, although they were not very church-going. Although I did go to a Sunday school as a child because I sang in the choir and this sort of thing. Although I used to argue with the pastor because I didn't believe in the monotheistic creator. And I had never heard, of course, of Buddhism or emptiness, but I used the concept of infinity. It was my favorite concept, and I used that concept to fend off the insistence by the minister that I had to believe something that didn't make sense to me. I didn't agree with that, you know, even as a child. And so I was delighted when I discovered Buddhism, but so therefore I love Buddhism and Buddha. And the Dalai Lama, you know, His Holiness, my teacher, my second greatest teacher and presently my greatest living teacher, he always insisted that he didn't want to convert anybody to Buddhism. And that people who were born Buddhists, naturally he taught them as Buddhists, but he would always say, every time he gives a lecture in foreign country, he said, anybody who's not a Buddhist, don't ever think I'm trying to make you a Buddhist by whatever I'm teaching you. If whatever I'm teaching gives you something useful to think about, some new understanding, some better way of living, makes you happy or something, that's wonderful. And you can use that within your grandmother's religion. But I want everyone to keep their grandmother's religion so grandma won't be unhappy. And also, I think it's important that in the modern world, where all the religions are pluralistically connected to each other, in every city, you have every kind of temple and synagogue and gurudwara and mosque and whatever. It's important that we don't have interreligious competition, which could become, you know, violent among fundamentalists and so on. And so therefore, I think it's very important that we try not to try to convert other people. So I always used to tell him that he wasn't converting me, that I just chose it myself. He said, of course, someone can decide they want to change, but it's very difficult, he said, for them, and it causes stress with their family often, and it also, on a higher level, could cause really serious stress. And he used to say that. He adopted that principle long before, you know, in the end, around in the 90s, we had this experience everywhere of sort of religious fundamentalism beginning to get involved more with politics, you know, worldwide. Sort of happened about 30 years ago. But he did that from 40, 50 years ago. He had that attitude, amazingly, you know. And I don't know if I completely agreed with him at first. I was more into, you know, let's have lots more Buddhists. And nowadays, I completely do agree with them, with him. And actually, I did in the before, I did a series of lectures once in San Francisco called Buddhism Without Buddhism. And that was before Batchelor wrote that book, because I think we do have beliefs, but we don't need the ism. This was my idea. And it was pretty popular, but not with some of the new Buddhists. They didn't like it, you know, but I think that's the way. So that reception is very good of all sorts of things about Buddhism, I think. But in a way, when it's open, it's like offering this, the strategies, the psychologies, the scientific understandings, the meditative altered states experiences, and so forth, and as an exchange of spiritual sciences, I think the reception of Buddhism is very, very good, very wide, and will become more good in the future, I think. And therefore, it's really important that the non-Buddhist people, like the Christians and the Jews and the Muslims and the Hindus, that they understand that the Buddhists are happy to share things, but they're not trying to grab market share of people away from them. They want people to use things in their own cultural setting and their own belief system setting. Although naturally, it will involve some theological changes. I think if people become more aware of Buddhist philosophy, Buddhist science, what I consider Buddhist science, they might change. There might be theological changes with their own traditions, I think.
Yeah.
And I look forward to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think when I want to ask you if you also see this. So when you look at the religious traditions, any way that the mainstream Buddhist ideas of non-self and negation and renunciation may not be as commonly shared by other religious traditions as more subtle, advanced philosophical topics like Buddha nature. You find many concepts across all religions which are very much similar to Buddha nature, talking about the ground, the perennial philosophy. So this may be a very good unifying force for religions, or at least one Buddhist concept that doesn't really go directly against other religious traditions in a very drastic way. Like,
yes, I think so. I think that we do have the expression in the Ratnakotri Bhaga, you find the expression of Dangmepe, Dharni Chembo type of thing, or Nairatmya Parama Atma. You find that Parama Atma expression, for example, in dealing in dialoguing with Hindus, you know, Vedantin, for example, they have their Parama Atma idea from the Upanishads. But we have the expression in the writings of Asanga and Maitreya and so forth, and even in the Tantras, we have the Nairatmya Parama Atma, the supreme self of selflessness. And so there's a way of understanding that is really not in conflict, or even the idea of the soul. For example, you know, there's another phenomenon in what Tibet's gift, the great gift of Tibetan Buddhism to world Buddhism as well as the world, I think. One of the great gifts is the more wide spread of tantric, what was previously esoteric knowledge, and the sharing of tantric wisdom with the world, sort of not totally formally, in other words, for initiation and high level, you know, sort of cultic practice. Not, there's no intention to make that widely popular, but as a blessing, or with a sort of general notion of what it is. That there is this idea of the Mishikpi Tigli, that the Tantra's beautiful, what I call Tantric Abhidharma. We don't have that expression in Tibetan, but you know, Sangaki Gumbizu, sort of, in Tibetan, we don't say that. But in a way, what the many, many shastras in the Tenure on Tantra, which are not the root Tantras, but the shastras of Tantra, they are like Abhidharma. You know, Mahayana stopped calling Abhidharma out of respect to the you know, Theravada, etc. You know, the 18 different schools of the monastic Buddhism. So they stopped using the word like Abhidharma, so to leave it for their Abhidharma. But still, except the Sangha wrote the one Mahayana Abhidharma. But so we don't really use Mahayana Abhidharma that much. And then Sangagi, Ngumbitsu, a strange expression in Tibetan language or even in Sanskrit, but it is what that is actually. In other words, it's the scientific organization of the theories and the science and the experiences and the methodologies of the esoteric advanced meditations. And I think it's very fascinating how it interfaces with neuroscience, personally. The idea of subtle body, chakra system, Zalung Tigle, et cetera. And I think that's a dialogue that is unstoppable now because the cat is out of the bag, so to speak. And the danger of it for some people, there might be some danger in that. But really, I think the only danger has to do with someone who's never had a kind of experience of the resilience or transformability of the self without even any religious idea. Modern people, because of the flood of information, because of the pluralism of the societies and the ideologies, they do have a kind of more split personality problem than they used to have, which in one way they always moan about. Some of them, more conservative ones, get all upset about it. But on the other hand, it's also a kind of experience of the transformability and the changeability of the self, that a strong self is resilient to change rather than is a fixed thing. So therefore, if they already have some erosion of the fixed self ideologies in the modern period, the danger of the, you know, Lai Ngarje, you know, the self identity as a Buddha in the esoteric is much less, I think. You have less danger of them becoming megalomaniacs. You know, it's still a danger, but I think I consider that the main danger about Tantra is the idea of adopting a new rigidity of the self based on sort of high initiation or some self-image of oneself as a Buddha. And then one becomes a fanatic, you know. But everybody's so shattered in their sense of self in most modern societies already that it's less of a danger, I think, one. And two, then the big danger of Madhyamaka that Nagarjuna warns us about has to do with the danger of people misunderstanding emptiness as nihilism, as nothingness. And that's not a danger anymore because everybody's already bitten by the snake of nihilism because none of them believe in future life. They don't believe in God. They don't believe in soul already. So they're already bitten by the snake of a misunderstood emptiness, you could say, or existentialism, as you know very well. So that's not a danger either. So somehow our advanced things that were previously advanced, I think this is, I'm responding to your question in that sense, things that were previously very, very kept, very, if not completely esoteric, at least hidden for the advanced people. You know, like your farmer, illiterate farmer, you wouldn't have been talking to them about Dagmepa, you know, Dagmenyi, because they're out there. Do you talk about Jimba, Tsutum, Tsopa, Lasopa? You don't talk about Dagme Sherap, you know, selflessness, you know. And so that's almost esoteric for the mass in an agricultural society. But in an overeducated, nihilistic, materialistic society, they're already ruined from a spiritual point of view, in the sense of no future life and life is meaningless and you just get what you can in life and grab it and then you die and you're nothing. And if you were bad, you have no consequence, etc. That's the general belief already. So Shunyata now becomes like a good antidote for nihilism, actually. And I think we have a responsibility to try to share it more widely. So anyway, I don't know. I don't know if that answers the question, but those are my thoughts on those topics. And therefore, coming back to Buddha nature, that's right. So then, you know, as you know, in like Dzogchen or this type of Mahamudra teachings and in Tantra philosophy, the idea of the Mishik Bintigle and this kind of soul theory ideas as a practical relational process of the dealing with the rebirth, dealing with the entering the clear light and the Book of the Dead type of thing. This is already out there, and I think therefore this will be helpful to people. And whether they are thinking, oh, this is my soul, and where the clear light is God, this touches within Sufism, within Christian mysticism, within Judaic mysticism, within Hindu mysticism, Vedanta. It touches on their idea of the potential, you know, experience of the divine in the human being, by the human being. And at least most of them have theories like there's a spark of the divine intelligence in the human being. And in the old days, they might have thought of that as a fixated soul. That's like a fixed, rigid identity. And that would have been considered from Buddhist psychology a weakness and a problem for them. But nowadays, you know, they can be pushed more toward the mystical direction by learning about Buddha nature, I think. And at least even if they misunderstand a little bit at first, as they're thinking of it as a fixed soul, in any way, it allows them to have a kind of sense of fellowship with Buddhism. And at least they won't think that Buddhism is sort of denying them their soul essence or something like that, you know? And I was really delighted. I was starting a little bit to use the word for the super, what I call the Shintotama Gyun, you know, so I was beginning to use soul process for that, S-O-U-L, soul. And then one time in a lecture of His Holiness in the late 80s, I think in the 90s, he said one time, oh, I think we can use that word, why not? He was saying, you know, because the old-fashioned translators of Buddhism would really get freaked out if you used the word soul, because they were taking Atma as soul. And so Buddhism had to be soulless. And then once you say it's soulless, then the modern religious person thinks of it as nihilistic or materialistic. And then that's the old cliche stereotype about Buddhism, that everything doesn't exist. So the Buddha nature, I'm delighted you are doing this series of conversations on Buddha nature, and Zata is making a big fuss about it, because I think it's very helpful. Its reception will be very helpful, even on a more simple level in the world. You know?
So if I may come in there, you raised a lot of issues. And for me, I was wondering now, when we use words like soul, mm-hmm. or when we choose to go with a more absolutist understanding that's shared by also other religious traditions, then as we leave the religious of domains and say go into secular society, into science, there are lots of philosophical thinking there, and there's rational egoism or moral egoism. Buddhism has been in some ways bringing a non-self antidote to egoism.
Yeah,
is the Western society not going to sort of fall for Buddha nature is also another sort of cornerstone to build further egoism? Is there any risk of associating that with self-centricity?
Well, there's a risk, yes. There's a risk of over-assimilating it, of course, to non-Buddhist ideas. That's always a risk. But in a way, at least for the religious people, if it goes more in the direction that Buddhists are truly spiritual. And this connects to another issue, which I'd like to raise. It's a debate I've been having in the past with His Holiness. And when he was invited to Muslim countries, once or twice he has been, unfortunately, sadly, the Chinese too much tend to block the visa, but he's been in a very good dialogue with Muslims in different times and places as much as possible, you know, given the current situation in the world. And there is that expression in India that Buddhism and Jainism are non-theistic. And, you know, then Hinduism is theistic and, you know, Christianity, Islam, they're all theistic, right? There's a general usage like that in India that everybody understands. And so His Holiness goes, he says, he likes to say, yeah, we're the non-theistic, we're one of the non-theistic traditions, speaking in terms of what he's used to from in India. But actually, of course, it's not correct, because we have we have lots of deities. And even in beginning Buddhism, you know, in the legend of Buddha's birth, Brahma and Indra are waiting for him when he comes out of his mother's womb, you know, steps out very painlessly and happily, luckily for the mom, comes out the side, and then Brahma, Indra are there, you know, giving bath and welcoming him. And he goes to the heaven to teach his mother, and then he comes back down at Sankhasya with Brahma and Indra escorting him. And there are so many Pali suttas where he's talking to deities all the time. It's the only that there's no, the Buddha criticizes correctly, I mean, logically, the idea of a single one who creates everything. That's considered a mistaken view, and correctly so. And even there's a wonderful thing in the Brahmajala Sutta where Buddha says there's a certain type of person who's a fanatic monotheist. And then he says, and why can you never convince that type of person that God, there is not a creator God? And he said, well, when that person in a previous life, recent previous life, was Brahma in a particular world, he thought when he wondered where everybody was at the beginning of the world cycle, and then other deities appeared around him, he thought that his wish for them had created them. So he thought he was the creator in that previous life. I think it was such a marvelous thing. I almost fainted when I read that. It's in the Pali Brahmajala Sutta, you know. And that's Buddha's analysis of why certain people are fanatic monotheists who can't change their view. And I just, amazing analysis, I thought, by Buddha's clairvoyance, supposedly. And but my point is that Buddha, so we are in a way relative theists, you could say, or we are theists but not monotheists, you could say, or we're theists but not creator theists. You know, I was trying to encourage him. You know, we had this debate once here in America, because he was going to a Muslim country, and he always says that he's from a non-theistic tradition. So I was trying to say, Your Holiness, when you say that to a pious Muslim in a Muslim country where they're not used to seeing, you know, being out like in New Delhi with all kinds of other worldviews, or in New York, and you say we're non-theistic, somebody will hear that like you're a demon, you know, you're like, you know, you should be destroyed. You are evil. I mean, subconsciously, they will have that reaction. The more educated ones will understand that you're speaking in terms of not a creator, but the other ones will freak out. So why don't you try to say, we believe in deities, we believe in spirituality, we believe in life, etc., but we don't believe in a creator. Just say, and he wouldn't agree with me. He said, no, that's what we say in India. Of course, we have a debate, so we sometimes don't. We agree not to agree, in a good Tibetan tradition. But then he said, well, what do you say? And then I say, well, you can say infinitheistic. I'm infinitheistic, and not said of monotheistic, infinitheistic, like infinite theistic, or mystical theistic, or say any other thing. Because, you know, the Abrahamic traditions, they are mystics like Meister Eckhart. You know, they have experiences of merging with clear light, which they consider God. And they realize, and they then teach, that you can't say God is humanoid, do you know what I mean, in the sort of popular way. It's like a person, you know, sitting there like a chief or something. And they have experiences like that, but they're suppressed in the more Western countries in the history of them. Those people often were executed, actually, as being heretics by the official church. Whereas in India, and therefore in Tibet and in East Asia, the Buddhists were able, in more wealthy countries, actually, I believe is the reason, less authoritarian countries, they were able to get away with being oneness, talking about being one with the divine, you know. So therefore, they didn't execute you if you said, oh, I experienced godhood, you know. Like Tattvamasi, you know, the Brahmins, for example, you know, or and Buddhists where, you know, you become Buddha, you know, and you become a Nirmanakaya, you know. Are you a tulku, by the way, yourself, Kamala? Get on tulku yimbe, tulku. Can I?
No, I'm not. Well, I suppose I am a rebirth.
You're not officially, I see. You know, there's a very funny, I know, but you probably are. But the point is that you're not officially. You know, we had one geshi from Ganda Monastery who passed away a few years ago, but he was very good sense of humor. And one time his students asked him, he was a friend of mine, I wasn't particularly his student, but some other younger ones were his student. And they asked him, they said, oh, Geshe-la, you're such a fantastic, wonderful yogi and teacher and so kind and blah, blah, blah. How come you're not a tulku, they said. And then he said this. He said, well, I always wanted to be, but all the good ones were taken. Do you get a joke? He said, I always wanted to be, but all the good ones were already taken. In other words, somebody else was, you know, Naropa or Telopa or whatever it was, you know, they were already, there was nobody left to be the reincarnation of, in other words, he would say, which I thought was marvelously funny. Anyway, that's a joke. I'm sorry, telling a joke.
I normally say, you know, people could always seem to be equal somebody from Sukhavati, so even more important.
Yes,
than
right.
From
right.
This world.
Exactly.
Bob, going back to Buddha nature, one of the efforts that we are really putting in is also to take Buddha nature as a philosophical concept or as a notion, a practical sort of concept that can be used to promote positive thinking. Because we live in a world which is filled with negative bias, you know, wicked world syndrome. There's so much sort of negativity around. And now, if you go beyond religion, there is a sort of host of a plethora of philosophical positions which are actually counteracting ideas like Buddha nature. So what would be a good sort of strategy or pathways to get into this philosophical
dialogue? I think that I understand that. To me, I think the nowadays, the way I understand, first of all, let me say one other thing. And that is that the actual original word, right, is Tathagata Garbha or Sugata Garbha. And the word Garbha in Sanskrit actually means a womb, you know, or it can mean even a fetus in a womb. And then Tibetans translate as Ningbo, which means essence more than nature. And it's really I think the Buddha nature in English usage comes from Chinese, where they think for Xing, you know, they use the word Xing, which means like nature. And I'm very fond of Nagarjuna's expression, Shunyata Karana Garbham, Dongyi Ningji Ningbojen. It's such a wonderful, and Tibetan, both in Tibetan and Sanskrit. In Tibetan, the sound of it is so wonderful. It's amazing. It was like a favorite word of Atisha. You know, he used to say. And it comes from Nagarjuna's Ratnavali, of course. So the idea of emptiness, instead of being, you know, because we use a lot for emptiness, the analogy or the metaphor, simile of space. So people, when they say emptiness, they think of an empty space. But that, of course, is not correct because, you know, form is emptiness, emptiness is form, you know, like in the Heart Sutra, you know, so therefore matter is just as empty as space, you know. So emptiness is something more inconceivable than just space. Although it's a good way of starting to think about it as a kind of simile, but therefore the idea that shunyata is like a womb, which is like a membrane of nurturing energy, right? Like a womb is where we take our bodies when we're conceived and we attach to the wall of it. And then we get the nurture from the mother's bloodstream through that wall, you know? So it's like an enfolding of beings in something positive that is nurturing and protecting them. And I think that we have to admit that all of the Asian Buddhist cultures were quite male chauvinist, patriarchal. So I don't think they were comfortable with this garba. So, they didn't ever want to translate as deshechebengel or deshechengel, you know, the like actual word for a womb, because a male, you know, monk, ex-warrior, but new monk, mendicant, doesn't want to have a womb, you know? And they don't mind having a nature, or they don't mind having an essence, but they don't want to have a womb. So I'm just saying, there's a funny thing in the actual original concept by Buddha, you know, where Prajnaparamita, right, is the mother of all Buddhas. So that sort of female imagery, you know, of clear light, you know, and the Vajrayogini kind of ideas are a little bit hidden, I feel, in the concept of Buddha nature. And for me, what Buddha nature is so good about is it enables Buddhists to feel that Buddha's still with them, that Buddha's so close, that Buddha's like right in them or with them or as them. It's even more inconceivable than something in you. It is you in a way. And, you know, I'm very fond of the Vimalakirti Sutra. As I don't know, did I ever give you a copy of my English version of that? I don't know if I ever did.
No, I didn't receive a copy, but I have been reading it.
I will bring one next time I come, I promise. I promise I will bring one. I really, you know, I love that sutra. And that sutra makes a very powerful argument about how the Buddha Kshetra, this Buddha, Dakshin, is the planet Earth. You know, this is Sabha. We call it in Tibet, what do we call it? Sabha, you know, Saha, you know, Suja, really, to be tolerated, you know, Saha. The Saha universe is this Buddha's, it's where we are now. Shakyamuni is in his thing, and he didn't leave. You know, the idea that his coarse body, he withdrew, of course, in his parinirvana. And then we even wrongly translate parinirvana as final nirvana. But pari doesn't mean final. Yongsu does not mean final. Tama. Yongsu does not mean tama. It just means total. So Buddha is everywhere here as the Dhammakaya. And we are still enfolded in his concern that we get to be Buddhas ourselves as soon as possible. You know, we're very stubbornly not doing it, but he wants us to, you know, and he's there with us. So the idea of what they would call in the Christian Protestant theologians would say, the pantheistic heresy, you know, the idea of the pan-Buddhistic heresy, like everything is Buddha, you know, which is the vision of Lotus Sutra. You know, it is the vision of the, in a way, it's a vision of Buddha nature. It's really the highest vision of Buddha nature. And in a way, it's what Shentong is getting at, although I don't agree with that way of doing it personally, because I feel it can be kept very logical as long as we're being logical. And to say that the absolute has properties to me is illogical, because it defies the meaning of the term absolute. And the whole thing of emptiness is the confirmation of the absoluteness of relativity, if you will, which is, of course, a paradoxical, contradictory statement. But nevertheless, that means when logic takes you to the brink of where, you know, you have to recognize that no verbal expression can possibly express what reality is anyway. So then you just drop out. But up until then, that there should not be illogic. Up until that brink, you know, I'm very strong about that. Anyway, I agree with Jadambuche about that one. But on the other hand, I appreciate the Shentong in that the Shentong thing is wanting to say, and I think Dolpa's experience for sure was the complete immanence, the presence of Buddha in everything and as everything. I get that. I do get, and I admire that. I feel he gets that from his Kalachakra vision, you know, vision of coming out of the stupa, the great stupa that he made, the great Kalachakra stupa that he built, right? And I feel that's wonderful. I do. But when it's presented as a philosophical logic, I cannot. I will always debate that. That's all. But I love it for the feeling. And so the Buddha nature thing, with or without the Shentong thing, either one, is a wonderful thing, I feel, for people to cheer up. You know, in my old age, one thing I have decided, and I think I say, is that people in almost every culture have been terrorized in history by their governments and by their religions, which are connected often to the governments. And they're terrorized in the sense of they're made to feel unworthy, they're sinners, they're ignorant, and hell is waiting if they're a little bit careless, and it's very dangerous, life is dangerous. So they need the protection of their guru, they need the protection of the king, they need the protection of the high priest, you know. So somebody needs to, they need to be saved by somebody else. You know, they don't have, they're not, reality is not safe. And I think that leads to a lot of aggressiveness and fear in people. And in a way it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy then, where they then ready to fight all the time. And so then they create conflict and then they do create a bad situation for themselves. And so I feel that Buddha's, I make a big fuss nowadays, which people can say I'm just old and sentimental, that they can say that, but I make a big fuss that even in the Four Noble Truths, in a way you could say he is teaching the closeness of Buddha to people in his third noble truth, because the only one that is really real is the third one. The first, second, and fourth are relative reality. They're paratantra, you know? And he says so right away. And only the third is his discovery. He didn't discover first one. Everybody knows about the first one. He discovered the third one. And then that enabled him to see the second one, which was the cause of the first one that everybody knew. And what he discovered was solution to the first one. So the freeing people from fear is what he's trying to do, in other words. And so that's why I like Shentong for its effort to free people from fear. The idea that there's goodness in ultimate reality, even when they say it's almost like a relational thing in a way, never mind, fine, no problem. If it cheers people up, because I just think people should be cheered up. And you know, there's a way that Buddhists can use the First Noble Truth on themselves and on others as a kind of a little bit to frighten people, you know, and get them. And in a way, sometimes you have to, like a bandit or a robber, you have to kind of get them to be worried. If they keep behaving badly, they'll have a bad result. So you have to be a little cautionary to them. So, I mean, there's a purpose for it, I understand, sometimes. But ultimately, I think human being is ready for being cheered up. It's what Shakyamuni discovered. And I want to honor that, you know. So that's Buddha nature thing. Therefore, I was so delighted when you honored me by inviting me to speak to you about this topic, because that's my main thing nowadays is third noble truth. Although I don't claim I attained that at all. I'm still wishing for it. And I hope to attain it one of these days. In fact, I feel confident I will, but maybe not in this life, maybe in a future life.
That's wonderful to hear, Bob, that you're confident that you will realize the third noble truth. Can you hear me? Yes, I think. This is a fantastic sort of remark as a closing, because the theme we chose today was Buddha nature as a foundation of freedom. Mm-hmm. And here you are very clearly illuminating how our own Buddha nature, the divine in us, is actually the base for liberation and freedom. And I must say, I got that message also from your fantastic translation of the Vimalaki Nirdesha Sutra, which I've been reading, although I didn't get a copy from you. I enjoyed it enormously. It's a fabulous translation. Thank you very much for that. I would like to ask you one last question before we take the question from the audience who joined us. I want to ask you if you do anything specific as a practice, not necessarily a religious practice, but a spiritual practice to put.
Well, yes, I try to. I tried to do this, Jay Rinpoche wrote this thing, Denzok. Rimni Denzok or something. I forgot now that I'm forgetting the title. That's of my age, you know. But, you know, where you practice Kerem and Zogrim together in a session. And, of course, I'm just playing at it, you know. I even have retreats with students who have initiation. I never give initiation. I don't feel competent to do that. And I'm not anybody's guru. But I'm a Kalyana Mitra, you know. I'm not actually officially a geisha. In Bhutan, people very generously call me geisha law, they do. But actually, I'm not a geisha. I didn't actually get the geisha degree at all. So I don't claim that. But I am, on the other hand, the meaning of geisha, that is Kalyana Mitra. I feel I am a spiritual friend of people. But when I do, I say, we are like children who have a little dollhouse. And then they play house, you know, and they serve tea in a little tiny cup, you know, and they do like it. So when we try to visualize the mandala of Guhya Samaj or something, we're like children playing house, you know, just in order to get something, to realize this marvelous, magnificent tradition with its fantastic teachings, you know, not to claim that we're doing some big practice because we're probably not capable. We're just really deepening our idea of emptiness and our idea of compassion and our feeling of compassion, but we don't pretend we can really do this. But on the other hand, we play at it. So I sort of play at that in some time like that. You know, I recite sadhana, which too much often is just katan instead of kandan. I just reread it, you know. And I try to do Kepche Lingyur Rinpoche, who was my second greatest teacher. He insisted that I should always do it in Tibetan. Even if I translated anything, I should still recite it myself in Tibetan, he insisted. He was very firm about it. And so I do. But, I will glance maybe sometimes at the translation or share it with someone else, but I will read it in Tibetan. And so I do that. And then I even, you know, try to do a little yoga. And actually, you know, there's a great new thing, Karma Rinpoche. I want to call you Rinpoche anyway, and I'm calling you Rinpoche, Karma Rinpoche. So there's a great new thing, Rinpoche, which is you are a Rinpoche to me. And that is that Hatha Yoga, which is so popular and is best way is taught where they don't lay too much heavily Hinduism on top of it. They teach it as a discipline to understand your body and even they get into subtle body. But it seems that Hatha Yoga comes from Vajrayana actually. And in between in the early second millennium, common era millennium, they kind of changed Vajrasattva to Shiva. A little bit, you know, Sanderson, you must have known Sanderson well since you were at Oxford. I met him only once, but I never debated him. I let him have his theory, fine, no problem. I refused to do that. But, you know, he thinks it all came from Shaiva, but it turns out it may be the other way around, but it doesn't matter because at the high level, it doesn't matter. You know, as you know, we've considered Shiva emanation of Chenasing. So, they don't yet have, they think Vishnu can be Buddha, but they didn't have an idea of Shiva like that. But Shiva's just a yogi, you know, he's a hippie. Shiva's the hippie god, you know, from before the avant la lettre, you know. So anyway, I'm just saying that those yogis are kind of doing some aspects of Trukor, you know, for Dzogrim Trukor. And they really are doing that. And they don't necessarily have the idea about the openness of self, you know, a little bit from Vedanta they do, but you know, some of them don't. So I think it's a very fruitful interconnection to do in a responsible, careful way. And I tried to do something like Dumont, you know, like some kind of yogas and thinking about this chakra and that chakra. So I try, but I consider it play. I don't consider I'm competent to really do it. And of course, I haven't had a result other than a little flash of a feeling about clear light must be there. And this Nang Che Ner Top Sum, I have a strong sense that's there, like Book of the Dead thing. And also Dzogrim, that's all in Dzogrim as well, as you know. And I'm trying to work on this Gyulu and also the Tong Suk of the Kala Chakra. I'm trying to understand that stuff. I really love it. And Dzogchen and Chagchen, all of that too as well. And so I like to play with these things and think about them and enjoy them and admire them to inspire me and anyone that I know to try to develop the prerequisites, the mundros, you could say, which maybe take a few lifetimes because they're so magnificent. And the horizon of potential possibility is so huge for the human being that to make a meaningful human life, it's, I think it's good that people have that kind of perspective, put it that way. So I try to do that, yes. And I get terribly busy and I forget the time. And nowadays, by the way, I'm almost 80 years old now. Next year I'll be 80. And one fact about being older is time goes more quickly. And you get up in the morning and you try to do one thing and suddenly it's nighttime. You just, there's no sense of time. It's incredible. And so therefore you feel a little bit sense of urgency, and you try to practice what you can. You know, on the other hand, I still lose my temper sometimes when somebody does something, it makes me upset, and I still feel this and that. So I'm, you know, I know I have my kleshas. I'm still carrying my bag of kleshas.
I would say you are the Geshe in real terms, Gewi Shingen, no? So Geshe-la, you're doing quite a lot to actualize your Buddha nature.
I'm doing my best.
As you said, time passes so fast, we are already past an hour. Marcus, are there any questions from other people?
Okay.
Yes, we have a few questions coming in right now. Can you hear me okay?
We can, but we can't see you, Marcus, in your beautiful background. Instead, we see you sitting on a couch. Oh, there you are. Oh, I love your background. That's the ocean of Buddhas behind you.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of questions coming in. One question that just popped up is, would you say something about the different presentations of Buddha nature between the early and later Tibetan traditions and how we could bring them together in relation to practice?
I think that's a better question for you, Genla.
That's a big question.
You're better at that than me. I'm not sure what they mean by the early and later. No, we're not hearing you. What happened?
I think you have to give us the honor, would be willing. I can chip in.
What's that? Are they referring to Shentong and Rangtong sort of thing?
I'm not sure.
From what I heard, it has to do with the early translation and the later translations, perhaps.
So that they're sort of above, that's a little bit above my expertise.
He's clarifying, really, he wants to talk about the difference between Yingma Kagyu and Gelugpa.
Oh, yes. Well, that's the Shentong. Well, I don't think it's all Nyingma and Kagyu. Are all Nyingma Shentong was? All Kagyu was Shentong was? I don't think so. I think there's a variety within the schools. And I can tell you that I don't know in specific, but Geshe Jamspel, the Ladakhi Geshe, who I work with a lot over the years, he was a Kachen actually from Tashilumbo rather than a Geshe, but we call him Geshe also. And he has the Kachen degree from Tashilumbo. It's like a Geshe degree. And he always used to say that even within the Gelugpa school, that at different points in its history, different scholars had sort of revelatory experiences, you know, of Buddha nature, you could say, that they, or Buddha essence or Buddha element, that they interpreted in a Shentong manner, and then they were criticized within the Gelugpa school. So I think it's better to realize that these schools have pluralistic, you know, arguments within themselves. It isn't like one school versus another. Then it can descend into a tedious sort of sectarian thing that is not a good idea. And I think there's this diversity. And basically, I believe that, for example, Dzongkhapa, who and Gyaltsep, who wrote the commentary of the Anuttara Yoga there, and I think he wrote that based on Tsongkhapa's teaching about the idea of the Deshek Ningbo, to try to give a cataphatic vision without going to the Shendong direction logically, because of his, you know, Tsongkhapa's very much was into trying to bring together the logic and the Madhyamaka. And that was his special job, according to the instructions he received from Manjushri, was to pay more attention to conventional reality. And so he didn't want anybody jumping off into sort of deep faith before they had used logic for in the sheer negation in the, you know, prasajja pratisheda, the megak of voidness, of emptiness, where they really hit clear light and they surrendered in a way to reality. Any conceptual idea that they knew what reality is in some conceptual way, that conceptuality could describe the inconceivable, he didn't like that, so he critiqued it. But they appreciate the cataphatic approach, which is the approach of seeing, you know, Buddha as greater than God, if you will. You know, if you read Pundarika's verses in the Vimala Prabha, the stainless light commentary of the Kalachakra, abbreviated Kalachakra Tantra, which is the one we have, Kalachakra is presented as practically the creator of everything. It's unbelievably theistic, actually. It's amazing. You could easily see how someone would really feel Kalachakra is everything, you know. And Mrs. Kalachakra, my goodness. Vishwamata, the Natsok Yum, what I call the multifarious mother. She has no atoms. She is pure energy, like chain reaction nuclear fission energy without atoms, and yet more powerful than any atomic form. And so talk about creative. On the other hand, they always want to not be responsible for creating suffering. You know, the theodicy problem in Western, in theistic, monotheistic religions is always an inescapable problem, where if there is an absolute force that creates the world, it has to be responsible for suffering and evil. And then faith cannot be complete, because there will be a subconscious suspicion. If God is omnipotent and God is omnicompassionate, what happened to me? People will not be able to avoid that, and the theodicy problem will not be solvable. So the Buddha gets out of that by going to the very brink of sort of infinite creativity, of clear light, and yet clear light doesn't do anything. And in a way, we can understand that. If you think of clear light, the way I like to think of it is, clear light is an infinite energy. But think about an infinite energy. Like, this is more power, like the Vajrayogini stands on a solar disk, which is not just a solar disk, that's million degrees Kelvin, or whatever they call scientists, very high temperature. But this is the intensity of a supernova, a Dume, Kalagni, a Dume, the end of the world, you know, a supernova energy. She just stands on it like it's a little disc, like a pillow for her. And that's a symbol that the mind, free of atoms, if you will, the energy level below atoms is unlimited. But an unlimited energy, infinite energy, will not do anything on its own initiative. It doesn't have initiative. Why? Because everything is already done from the point of view of infinite energy. There's nothing to be done. So therefore, people can draw themselves from the well of infinite energy, people who need to do something, but some being that needs to do something. And maybe Buddha's compassion needs to help beings so they can shape forms like Nirmanakayas out of this infinite energy, as many as they want. Infinite number of saviors they can send out. That's Shedesik, you know, Dharma. But the point is that the infinite energy itself doesn't do anything. So this is the same thing you have, the idea of Lundrup, of Buddha's Trinle as being effortless and spontaneous and et cetera, et cetera. In other words, not an effort. Anabhisamskara, you know, Dumache. So in that area, as the great, what was his name? Dakshin Rinpoche, not Dakshin Rinpoche, the other one who lived in Seattle, the great Sakyapa. And someone asked him about older Shentong and Rangtong. He said, his answer was, what's his name? Wonderful Lama.
Oh, Dejung Rinpoche.
Dejung Rinpoche.
Dejung, that's right, Dejung Rinpoche. He said, oh, what do I think about it? Here's what I think about it. Shentong la jiao su xiu, Rangtong la jiao su xiu. And I like to think that's my attitude as well. And that's, yeah, I think that's Jay Rinpoche's attitude, because he defended Kalachakra. You have to remember, his Sakya teacher, Rendawa, said he was nervous about Kalachakra. What is this Tong Suk? We don't like Tong Suk. You know, we're not empty void body or void image or void, you know, no atoms body. We're not worried about that, etc. He had 14 different points he worried about Kalachakra. And Jay Rinpoche loved Kalachakra. And he respects Kalachakra lineage from Jonang. But he doesn't agree philosophically about on the sort of regular level of reasoning. He wants to be this idea that the absolute can have qualities, he can't deal with that. So, but he respects completely. He also shows to the feeling of the complete immanence of the absolute love with the shunyata karana garbham, voidness, the womb of compassion. And you know, this relates to one thing. I just want to say one thing about it. I'm going off on my own agendas, but never mind. And that is this. There are some people nowadays who have been studying with the scientists about compassion. And then they're into this thing that compassion and empathy are different. And I'm sure their own compassion and empathy are different, because this is not yet Buddha's compassion. But Buddha's compassion is complete empathy. It is not a withdrawal from empathy and then you bring up some other ingredient. Although in a way there is another ingredient which we would call bliss. Bliss, great bliss, is so powerful that you can be fully empathetic at the same time without losing the bliss, which is inconceivable. So I've said that and it doesn't mean anything. I don't pretend that, I just said it all. But I'm pushing it to the point of where we realize that what a Buddha is, why he's inconceivable. He's melted into Dechen, orgasmic bliss, embracing the entire universe, like which is what Mahamudra, the great, the whole universe is his consort, if you will, you know. And I use orgasmic instead of that euphemistic Snellgrovian innate Lenje. This is Pomo Lenje, Sisirula. So I'm saying that, and that's so powerful that therefore, when he feels Bob Thurman's or your suffering, my suffering, Rinpoche's suffering, Marcus's suffering, he fully feels it the way we feel it. And he can do it without losing bliss, but yet he also fully feels it. And that's why he can help us, because he knows, he's like the doctor, CAT scan, who knows exactly what your sickness is, what is your klesha, because he feels it, he experiences your klesha. So he knows what you need as an antidote to your klesha perfectly. And the bliss enables him. And it's like you and me sometimes, if we're really in the flow, we're jogging, we're like freaking out, or we're in love or whatever it is, and then we bump our foot or stub our toe. Somehow, well, toe, we will don't feel it, but we know it happened, but we don't really get into it being painful. And then later, oh, when we're, then it's ow, you know. But it's possible to feel two things at once, in other words. And this is the extreme of that. When the extreme of that means inconceivability of that. So we can't settle Shen Tong, Rang Tong. You can't settle either one. So therefore, Jiaozi showed to both of them. One of them just means you go all the way to give up your selfishness. And the other, and you feel everything of everybody. You open yourself to everything. And the other one is you're really happy. You're so happy it's absolute. So you can say, oh, the absolute is happy. You can say, no matter what.
That's great. That leads into one other question we have here about, could you advise us how to cope with depression and stress from the teachings of Buddha nature, from that point of view, especially yes. in this time of strife?
Yes, I'll wade into that. And that is, the way you do it is the way that you use, you know, the seventh and eighth branches of the Eightfold Path. You use combination of mindfulness and samadhi. And samadhi being one-pointedness, mindfulness being like vipassana, you know, scanning, laktong, you know, it's discursive meditation. And what do I mean by that? You put your samadhi on the idea that Buddha is in you. So you're already there. And when you get there, this is my consolation prize. What I call it, what I developed for myself. I awarded it to myself. And that's to console me for being a loser of after 54 years of studying Buddhism, 56 years of studying Buddhism, no more, 60 years of studying Buddhism, I still didn't attain nirvana. But my consolation is, that's because I'm still trapped in time. And which is a horrible place to be, trying to be in the moment when there is no moment. It's just past meeting future. Like that, the moment is like has no duration, really. So you can never get there. You keep trying to step in there and it's not there. Anyway, I'm sorry. So point is, when I get nirvana in some future life, I am going to realize I was always in nirvana. That's why Buddha was able to remember infinite previous lives two steps before nirvana under the tree. Remember, he remembered all his previous lives. Why didn't he remember them before that? Because we don't want to remember where we thought we were suffering. But when you get nirvana, time collapses and you're free at all time. And you realize that the uncreated, you were always in the uncreated, because the uncreated is all this mess. That's what it is. And he realized that he'd always been there and had not realized it. He'd had always had the Buddha nature was always him. And so that's what we will do. So the point is, I'm not in nirvana now, and we are not, I presume, here. And maybe some of you are, actually, I'm not sure. But the point is, when we get to nirvana, we'll realize we are in nirvana now. And we'll revise our experience of where we are now, such as to realize it's really enjoyable, even on Zoom. It's blissful. It's made of bliss, the whole thing. So, but what, I'm sorry, that's, I'm just indulging in that. But what I'm saying to the depression thing is this, you put your one point on Buddha's good news that nirvana is everywhere. It's the reality of everything. So in reality, if you only knew fully what you know deeply, what your cells know, let's say, your subatomic particles or your subatomic energy, subparticulate energy knows, is that everything is fine. You're in the flow. But you then use your mindfulness to find the narrative in your mind that's telling you, oh no, Bob, this really sucks. Oh, you did such a bad thing yesterday. Oh, you have such bad thoughts. Oh, no. Oh, hell. Oh, God, the Republicans will win again somehow. Oh, oh, no. Oh, they're still in there. Oh, Mitch McConnell is still there. It's like, you know, now, et cetera. In other words, all these negative things will come in your mind because that's what you're conditioned. You've been terrorized by your culture to think everything is awful, that reality sucks. And you should be scared, and being sensible is to be resigned to it and scared of it and defend yourself and hide and escape from it even. And you have to review those things and then bring to bear. Then you have to learn more in between meditating and keep reading and create a new narrative. Read the Sublime Continuum. Read all those wonderful books of Zadas on Buddha nature, the beautiful books, all those retranslations of all the Maitreya books, they're just beautiful. Brunholzl, those guys, they're hyperactive, those guys. I don't know how they publish and write so many things with so many footnotes. It's fantastic. And you have to read them and read them and read them. That's meditating. That's vipassana, is reading them, because that's creating a new narrative for you. And in the new narrative, everything is fine. And then you begin to, the new narrative gradually replaces the old narrative. Reasonably, it gives you reasons, and you begin to see the holes in the old narrative. For example, it takes a long time. You know, I argued for years with people in the natural sciences about their nihilism. Nah, there's no future life, that's ridiculous. Bob, come on, what's your evidence? They all go sneering around like that contemptuously. And then you say, well, there is evidence, and then they dismiss it. Oh, that's just religious fanatics, superstition, blah, blah, blah. They go like that. And then it took me 40 years to realize there's one overwhelming argument against them, which is, which one of you guys discovered the nothing? Who got the Nobel Prize for the discovery of nothing that waits for you at death? Which person? Who? Just tell me. Or maybe was it Descartes? Or who discovered nothing? Newton, did he discover it? Einstein? And of course, they can't really point to anybody because obviously nobody is ever going to discover nothing except an insane person because nothing is nothing. But, you know, to really figure out that what that means frees you from fear of nothing or from fear of, and then the whole idea that God in this Western, you know, monotheistic culture, that God is all powerful and loves you like a son, like a daughter. But then it's got eternal hell waiting for you in case you had a little fun, went to a rock concert or something, or took a drug, or I don't know what, danced. That your hell is waiting. I mean, that's just so demented. Why should you believe that? So you absolutely should not. So depression has to do with you're telling yourself that everything is horrible and you have to retell it. And you read Eckhart Tolle, you know, he was about to kill himself and suddenly he heard another voice, which was his samadhi voice that said, but moved into mindfulness, vipassana. And it said, why are you listening to me, to that voice that tells you everything sucks? How do you know that? Don't listen to it. A different voice of himself. He found another voice, a saving voice. And he didn't kill himself. And he became Oprah's guru. And he's a great guy. He's really nice. Okay. So that's about depression. We're all depressed. It's a depressing that we are just a bunch of weird bacteria. We're a bunch of elaborated bacteria with a nice beard and a goatee and glasses sitting in front of some Buddhas. We're just a meaningless bacteria. And we're on this thing that we wrecked a thing and we're about to destroy it completely by the planet. And Bhutan will be flooded with melted glaciers and everybody will be destroyed because we just keep turning on all our like gas guzzling cars and trucks and crappy agriculture growing crappy food. And we're just gonna destroy it and it's all meaningless anyway. We're just all going to be nothing. So not going to, we're no hell, don't worry. We'll just be nothing. So who cares if we wreck the planet? as long as some people in Texas remain rich until they're dead. That's a sick, depressing worldview, and that's the one you were brought up in, and I'm brought up in. Geshe-la Rinpoche is not brought up in that. He is brought up in a more positive culture. And he, but he learned, he knows about us. He went to Oxford. He saw us. And he's compassionate about us. So he talks to us about Buddha nature.
Yes, Bob, relatively speaking, we are slightly better off here with the environment and with politics and whatnot. But I think you basically touched the last question I wanted to ask you. But before I ask that, I actually want to chip in a little bit to the last two questions as well. As Bob, you pointed out, we have to appreciate plurality even within Tibetan Buddhist traditions themselves. And I think the understanding of Buddha nature is also very nuanced, that we cannot use a broad brush, say Gelugpas or Rangtongpas, Nyingmapas or Kajupas or Shantong. I think there are
good, we agree.
Traditions within the schools. From the luminosity aspect, other more from the emptiness aspect. So, still, you approach.
Your audio is slowing down. Okay.
Yes. So, with that, now I think one of the things that when people phrase the question, we hope that they you didn't want to use the word innate, but some orgasmic bliss, but whatever we call it, the positivity we have in us, we hope will encourage people to think good of themselves. And I think particularly be grateful for the beautiful, perfect world we actually live in. I mean, yes, there are imperfections, but we also have perfect perception of those imperfections.
Yes.
The imperfections being perfectly imperfect.
Yes, of course.
So the last question, Bob, is what book would you recommend people to read to really get further into Buddha nature? And I think we have really gone now 1.5 hours, so we'll wrap up after that.
Well, you know, the books, I would recommend your Zajra books. You know, Brunholzl has his own translation, I think, of the Sublime Continuum, or the Uttara Tantra, whatever he called it, I forget. I have it over there, but I forgot, but I think I have it. Yeah. So any of the Maitreya books, there's the Mahayana Sutra Alankara, there's the Uttara Tantra, those two, I think, most, the Dharma Dharmata and the Madhyanta Vibhaga are not so key, but those two books, if someone is very philosophically inclined, of course, they're very complicated and very philosophically inclined, and they would read those. And I think the Sublime Continuum in our series that will be coming out with Wisdom in its second edition, but its earlier one was from Columbia Press. And then there's the Mahayana Sutra Alankara. We have a Mahayana Sutra Alankara version also. And so I would compare several versions and read them all. But I'm trying to think if there's a lighter book. What would you recommend, Geshe-la, if someone's not so philosophically overwhelmed with it, you know, not wanting to go into really technicality, massive footnotes, et cetera, like our books, you know, which are pretty highfalutin, which books are like at a more simple level can make it very strong, do you think? Did you write one yourself? On the Buddha nature, that is a shorter one, that's more, simplified?
No, I haven't written anything long on Buddha nature yet. I would recommend certainly is to visit the Sadra Buddha nature website, because we have a very gradual introduction to Buddha nature.
Okay, good. Going from, and that's to recommend that. I have to, I get bad. People send me website addresses and then I lose them. And I'd like to please send me the link, Marcus, and I'll get on there and look at that. So I'd recommend anything on that website. absolutely. And, but start with the smaller, simpler things, and then do it critically. In other words, you create the new narrative with your samadhi as your meditation, but check out why you are sold on your old narrative, because you didn't challenge it strongly enough. So that you have to extricate yourself from the depressing idea that reality sucks, if you want to open your mind to the idea that reality could be pure love. Because after all, what shunyata karana garbham, you know, emptiness is the womb of, or has the nature of, compassion. Shunyata karuna garbham. And karuna means, you know, ningje, you know, the expansion of the heart. So Buddha has a heart. Buddha's not just a machine that tells you everything is empty and you can escape into that. No, Buddha is telling you that everything is empty means that everything loves you and everyone else. And therefore you're like someone who is happy with your mother. The reality is a mother that wants to embrace you, you know? And that's what Buddha is. You know, they say Buddha is like a mother who considers every being, and not just every human being, every animal, every being, every sentient being, every sensitive being, like a mother considers her only beloved child. That's what a Buddha is. And if what a Buddha is someone who has experienced their whole body is the whole of reality, which is an unlimited, infinite relativity, then that means that all Buddhas are embracing you right now. And they're in love with you. And they're just, they're not even frustrated that you don't realize that you're loved by everything, because they know that you will. They're that kind of determined mother, what Winnicott called a good enough mother, that knows that you will reach there in your sense of time, because your sense of time itself is confused, and his or her or its sense of time, the mother's sense of time, the mother prajnaparamita, transcendent wisdom, is not confused, and it knows that all time is always present. So your future time will be your real time, your experiential time eventually. That mother knows that. She will not stop cradling you at her breast of Dharma teaching, at her breast of science, at her breast of literature and poetry, etc. She will not stop nursing you there until you're ready to digest it. I don't know, that's a weird metaphor. Never mind. All the best, okay?
But that's a beautiful way to end this session. So let us sort of dedicate our merits. Let's wish that this conversation and whatever good we are doing and will do in the future bring. So may all beings attain the state of lasting well-being and flourish in both health and spirit. And Geshe-la, Bob, thank you very, very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Everyone who has joined us from all over the world. Thank you, and good night from Bhutan.